From NPR News in New York, this is the Bryant Park Project with Allison Stewart and Luke Burbank.
It is Wednesday, July 18th. Hello, I'm Allison Stewart, along with Luke Burbank.
Hi, Allison. Have you seen the one review of our show, of our podcast on iTunes? It's so brutal. And I was showing it to my kid last night to show off that we're on iTunes, and then there was someone just saying that her daddy is terrible at doing radio shows.
Well, he identifies himself as RPB78. We think you stink, too. Yeah. All right, so moving on to a higher level of discourse, we dive beyond the headlines on the National Intelligence Estimate released yesterday, and we'll go on rumor patrol about the viral marketing campaign surrounding the mysterious new J.J. Abrams movie.
And also, speaking of mysteries, we're going to go to Iraq where there are reports of giant monkey-headed badgers that are terrorizing people.
The story makes me laugh, and it shouldn't. First, let's get an update with our own news badger, Matt Martinez.
Thanks, Luke. Thanks, Allison. Here are some of the latest headlines from NPR News. A sleep-deprived, divided U.S. Senate voted down a Democratic plan to withdraw U.S. combat troops from Iraq by the end of April 2008. The 52-47 vote fell short of the 60 votes needed to cut off debate under Senate rules. It was the ending of an around-the-clock debate on Iraq. Republicans denounced the filibuster as a stunt by Democrats. MSNBC's David Schuster has been up all night with Congress. We'll get the scene from Capitol Hill in just a few minutes. A new national intelligence estimate says that al-Qaeda terrorists in Iraq will likely mount an attack in the U.S. within the next 3 years. The report outlines how al-Qaeda has rebuilt its operational capabilities and senior leadership and restored safe havens along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. Meanwhile, military officials say that a senior operative for al-Qaeda in Iraq has said that a prominent al-Qaeda-led group called the Islamic State of Iraq is just a front and its leader is fictitious. The pilot of the Brazilian airliner that burst into flames after trying to land in Sao Paulo yesterday apparently tried to take off again, barely clearing rush hour traffic on a major highway. So far, 189 people are confirmed dead. It may go up to 200. The numbers include passengers as well as people on the ground who were killed when the plane cleared the airport fence at the end of the runway and slammed into a gas station. Pro wrestler Chris Benoit was on steroids when he killed his wife and young son and then hanged himself. But investigators stopped short of saying whether this played a role in the killings. Besides steroids, Benoit's body tested positive for Xanax and the painkiller hydrocodone. Atlanta Falcons quarterback Michael Vick and three others were indicted by a federal grand jury on Tuesday, charged with competitive dogfighting, procuring and training pit bulls for fighting, and conducting the enterprise across state lines. The grisly details in the indictment coming up later in the broadcast. David Beckham's new team, the LA Galaxy, lost 3-0 to Mexico's Tigres yesterday. Beckham is nursing a sore left ankle, and it's yet to be determined whether he'll be able to make his much-anticipated debut when the Galaxy play Chelsea FC in an exhibition match on Saturday night. The game is already sold out. ESPN is set to televise it. And a 39-year-old psychologist has won the World Series of Poker. Jerry Yang won the top prize, $8.25 million. He came from the back of the pack, knocking out seven of the eight other players at the final table. Those are some of the latest headlines from NPR News. The news is always online at npr.org. I'm Matt Martinez.
For weeks, I'm saying we got to get more Richie into the show. Finally, it comes true. This is the Bryant Park Project, as you might already know. I'm Luke Burbank. Allison Stewart's here. And we had quite a night on Capitol Hill last night. There was like a big Senate slumber party. I think I actually saw tape of Olympia Snow putting braids in Patty Murray's hair. And then like Barack Obama stole John Kerry's underwear and froze
that rascally Barack.
I know. They played Truth or Dare. Actually, what happened was they were having a sort of big debate about the war in Iraq, and the Republicans were sort of not into having a straight up or down vote, something we're going to get into in a little minute. The thing, though, that happened was people got tired.
They were there at 4 o'clock in the morning. The Senate has not had a vote past 4 a.m. since 1994. Yeah. I don't think so many people have been up that late since 1994.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, once Matlock is over and Murder, She Wrote, most of these people just, whoop, like a glass of Clamato, and then they go right to bed. But here's what Hillary, our senator from this very state of New York, sounded like at about, I don't know, 3:30 in the morning.
And yet I wrote several weeks ago to Secretary Gates and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Pace, asking whether there is planning, very specific planning, not the usual response, oh, yes, we plan for everything, we plan for every contingency. What is the planning that will protect our troops?
So that happened about 4:30 in the morning. And if you thought that she needed a grande latte, check out Norm Coleman, who came next. This man needed a venti.
Senator from Minnesota is recognized.
Mr. President, I would note that if we adopt the Reed Levin Amendment, that we would be doing what the senator from New York says we shouldn't do. She noted that we must not redeploy out of Iraq with the same failure of planning that we had going in.
That's a tired fellow. That all-nighter was called by the Democrats, who are pretty peeved that the Republicans won't allow that up or down vote on the Reed Levin Amendment to withdraw troops from Iraq by April. It was a 52-47 vote, fell short of the 60 votes needed to cut off debate under Senate rules.
Mm-hmm. Norm Coleman later moved to have 5 more minutes, Mom, which was an unprecedented congressional activity. Somebody who was actually there a lot of this morning, last night, whatever, watching it was MSNBC's David Schuster, and he's been kind enough to stay up long enough to talk to us. Hi, David.
Hi. Great to be with both of you. See, I can't talk.
You've been up late as well.
Yeah, you have a total excuse for any mistakes that you make on any of the MSNBC or NPR broadcasts throughout the day. Could you just start off kind of set it up for us. This, what was going on with the votes and the filibuster? This was not a simple, we're going to vote on something, and if it gets more than 50 votes, it goes through. What was all this fighting about?
Right. Essentially, and it wasn't even really a filibuster per se. I mean, the Democrats had said, look, we've got more than 50 votes to pass this thing, and the Republicans kept saying, well, too bad, because we're going to hold you to the normal standard of 60 votes in order to actually bring this to a vote. And then the Democrats said, okay, well, if you're going to stand by those rules, then we're going to schedule debate through the night, and you guys can explain all night long why you're not going to allow us to have just a straight up or down vote. So it was more sort of parliamentary maneuvers. The same sort of thing happened a couple of years ago when the Republicans wanted to get some of their judges through, and the Democrats were saying, no, you're going to have 60 votes in order to bring the judges to a vote. And so the Senate Majority Leader at the time, Bill Frist, said, okay, well, then we'll just have the Senate meet all night in session, and they sort of did. So it was another, you know, one of these sort of tactics. Interestingly enough, I mean, how rough it got last night was really up to Harry Reid. If he had wanted to, he could have scheduled some votes literally every half an hour to keep senators from essentially ever leaving the Senate chamber. He was urged by Senator Dianne Feinstein of California not to do that, and instead of doing it every couple hours, they had a vote at about midnight that everyone was required to come back to, and then they were supposed to have another one at 2 or 3 in the morning, and Reid sort of back down and said, no, we'll have the next one at 5. So some senators were able to get a couple hours of sleep. It was funny, though, I must say, this morning to see John Kerry with bedhead and looking like he had been in the same suit all night long.
He's got a lot of hair to have bedhead.
And, of course, everybody was trying to figure out where David Vitter was last night. If he was leading to spin the bottle or whatnot.
So can I just ask, how do they decide which issues are going to be a 60-vote thing as opposed to, I mean, there's 100 senators, you would think 51 of them vote for something and then that should pass. But there are certain issues that are, I guess, deemed so important that you need to get 60. And this was one of those, and that was sort of part of the argument too. Like, how do they decide what issues are going to have that threshold?
Well, some, if it's a spending issue, I believe it requires 60. I'm not entirely certain about that. But it just depends. I mean, usually, I mean, for example, on defense authorization bills in the past, there are all sorts of amendments that they've attached, aside from the Reed Levin Amendment, but there are all sorts of other ones where it's been just a straight up or down, you need 51 to pass it. But on something that's pretty momentous, the argument seems to have been, at least the Republicans held on to this argument last night, that no, we're going to use standard business, which is 60. And I think that's sort of the distinction between, of course, the Senate and the House. In the House, it's majority rules and that's it. The Senate is seen as some sort of place where, because you usually need 60 to sort of cut off debate and get to a straight up or down vote, you almost always have to have this sort of 60, at least supporting the idea that there should be a vote on something. And the idea is that it tends to lead to sort of more compromise and cooler heads and more sort of middle-of-the-road kind of amendments that come out of the Senate. But clearly, I mean, last night the test was whether or not some of those Republicans who have said that they're now opposed to the way the war is going, whether they would cross over and join the Democrats. And we're talking about senators like Richard Lugar of Indiana, and John Warner, Virginia, and they basically balked. And they said, look, even though we're not happy with the way this war is going, we're not ready yet to endorse the idea of starting to pull out troops in the next 3 or 4 months. So the Democrats did not get them to join their side. And as you mentioned, I think they fell 8 votes short of being able to end debate.
Now, what the Republicans have been saying is that this is just a big PR stunt by Harry Reid, who's the top Democrat over in the Senate. But the question is, it certainly got a lot of PR. Cover the New York Times today, like a photo of these cots that people may or may not have slept in. Did this actually – is there any sense that this might actually work and that this might put pressure on Republicans?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, sure, it's a PR stunt, but you could argue that, you know, most of what goes on in Congress, whether they're photo ops or news conferences, I mean, they do stunts all the time on both sides. I think this one was fairly effective in that the Democrats had been arguing and been trying to maintain that, look, you know, if people are angry at Congress, as they are, don't blame the Democrats. We've been doing everything we can to try to end the war, but the Republicans are blocking us. And I think, like last night and again this morning, for about 24 hours in this news cycle, I think it was fairly clear the Democrats were able to make their point that, yes, the Republicans are keeping this vote from happening. And it's the Republicans who, for whatever reason, and some reasons may be valid, but the Republicans are not letting this do a straight up or down vote. And given, again, that the poll numbers for Congress overall are so bad, I think Democrats felt like they needed to make some sort of dramatic gesture to show that the Democrats are doing everything they can to end the war, but the Republicans are holding firm against that.
Biggest ratings for C-SPAN ever.
A lot of business for Domino's Pizza last night, too. Apparently, there was quite a fight in the Democratic caucus last night about whether what kind of pizzas they would order, because Harry Reid is not a fan of pizzas, but his colleagues prevailed upon him, and they got a bunch of pies.
David Schuster of MSNBC, thank you for staying up, and take a shower. I can smell you through the phone.
Yeah, I need one.
All right. Thanks, man.
Thank you both. Take care.
Federal conspiracy, transporting and training dogs for illegal fighting are just some of the charges facing an NFL superstar quarterback, 27-year-old Michael Vick of the Atlanta Falcons. He was indicted yesterday, along with 3 other people, for allegedly running this dogfighting venture, one that was both illegal and incredibly cruel. If you go to thesmokinggun.com, Luke, and you read the indictment, it's 18 pages. There's some stuff in there that just, it's so very creepy. Electrocuting dogs, shooting dogs. According to the indictment, over 50 animals were found in the house, some in some pretty bad shape. Jeremy Redman with the Atlanta Journal-Constitution joins us from Richmond, Virginia, where the indictment was actually filed. And Jeremy, now, Michael Vick owned the property where this business called Bad News Kennels operated. Now, how were authorities tipped off that something wasn't going right at 1915 Moonlight Road?
Really, I've come into this story late in the game. I'm reporting here in Richmond on the legal case of this proceeding, so I'm not equipped to talk about what's transpired before this. But they have indicted him and other defendants in the case, and I've already set a hearing for the initial appearance for July 26 before a federal district court judge here in Richmond.
So who was actually named in the indictment?
You've got 4 individuals, Michael Vick being one, Tony Taylor, Aquanus Phillips, and Pernell Peace. They all go by nicknames, and Vick's happens to be Ookie.
Appropriately named, mysterious and Ookie, actually. So give us some examples of what they've been indicted on.
Well, the indictments are traveling interstate commerce and using the mail to essentially commit a crime. And the other one is knowingly sponsoring and exhibiting an animal fighting venture.
What kind of charges does he face?
Well, those are the two charges.
I'm sorry, I meant penalties. I'm sorry, I misspoke. What kind of penalties does he potentially face?
Yeah, those are could carry prison time and substantial fines. Although I don't have those amounts in front of me.
Jeremy, I don't know if you actually really follow football, but I'm wondering, I mean, it seems like it's getting a lot more attention because this guy's a football star? Like when you're at the courthouse, is there sort of a hubbub there, and are there like more people? Is it kind of a bigger deal?
Certainly, anything Michael Vick does draws intense public scrutiny in Atlanta. He's incredibly famous as the quarterback of the Atlanta Falcons, and the case is most definitely taking up more attention than perhaps if it was, you know, not an NFL player. I've been to the courthouse this morning, and you already have several television news crews out there, including ESPN, Fox affiliate, and the CBS affiliate. So it's drawing considerable attention at this point.
And, Jeremy, what has Michael Vick or Michael Vick's lawyer said at this point?
I'm sorry, can you repeat?
What has Michael Vick or his attorneys said at this point about his involvement?
Attorneys, we've not been able to reach his attorney today. Vick has repeatedly declined comment, although weeks ago he denied any wrongdoing in the case.
All right, Jeremy Redman from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, thanks so much for joining
us. My pleasure.
And you know what, Luke, it was interesting. I was just Googling that a little bit, and this was originally tipped off as a drug case. They thought there was drug activity in Michael Vick's house, and imagine that they found all of this.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of things that you could probably do as an NFL player that are kind of bad, and maybe people wouldn't get mad at you. You start potentially harming dogs or allegedly harming dogs. I don't know. This is going to be interesting to watch what this does to his, like, public image.
It's amazing. He's done it practically through his entire professional career. They think this has been going on since 2001, so this is a to-be-continued.
Well, from a mess at Michael Vick's house to a hot ghetto mess.
It's a new show debuting next week on BET. Some people not happy about it. It's people acting a fool, mostly African Americans. The creators and the host of the show, they say they're doing this for a good cause. That's straight ahead on the Bryant Park Project from NPR News. You're tuned into the Bryant Park Project from NPR News.
I'm Luke Burbank.
And I'm Allison Stewart. A new show is going to debut on BET called Hot Ghetto Mess. Now, it's based on a website of the same name, which features all this user-generated video depicting a certain aspect of urban life. So to speak. Now, here's a clip from Hot Ghetto Mess's website. It's called Crackheads Gone Wild. This gentleman's name is Mike Holla.
Yizzo, welcome back. Your boy's in the building. Mike Holla, Hood TV. All the best doing what I do. I'm out here in the streets. This is like episode, I don't even know what episode it is, but the name of this episode is called Dope TV. It's Hood TV, but it's Dope TV. We're going to look at all the crackheads today out in the streets. I'm going to show you how they work.
Is there any other way that crackheads go than wild, to be honest?
Now, if you don't know what a hot mess is, because, you know, sometimes my friends and I say, oh, you look a hot mess. If you go to urbandictionary.com, here's a definition. Something distasteful or unattractive in nature, unpleasant or offensive when used in a sentence. That multicolored weave she's rocking is a hot mess. Okay, so you got the idea. Now, broadcasting these videos of people for Hot Ghetto Mess is, the founders of the show say they're doing it because they think we got to do better. They want people to rethink how they're living their lives. Now, some people think the whole concept is bad news and reinforces degrading stereotypes. The show hasn't even aired yet, Luke, so we want to find out more. Charlie Murphy is the host of the show. He's joining us. Hey, Charlie, how would you describe something or someone who is a hot ghetto mess? What does that mean?
Just somebody that's out of control. And usually they're out of control due to their own, it's just due to ignorance, you know what I'm saying? It's just because they don't know no better. They some of these things happen, you know?
So explain to me, Charlie, the format of the show. What's your role going to be, a host?
Well, the format of the show actually is like holding a mirror up and saying, look, you know, do you realize that this is what you're giving off and that it's not really cool. You know what I'm saying? That's the whole focus of the show. That's why I got on board. Once Reggie explained to me what they was trying to do, I was like, hey, this is something positive. And, you know, I got involved.
So when I turn on Hot Ghetto Mess next week, so what will I see?
You're going to see, of course, you're going to see Charlie Murphy.
Yes, we will see Charlie Murphy, and that's a good thing.
Yeah, you know, you're going to see me, and we're going to be going, showing some clips. But, you know, the way we approach it is lighthearted. And it's going to be, for the most part, you're going to be laughing. But at the same time, you're going to, you know, for those of us that need it, you're going to be learning something as well, you know. And at the end of the day, man, I just hope everybody sees it for what it is. It's just another effort to make a statement and to try to help people.
All right, Charlie, I'm going to ask you to hang on because we've got Jam Donaldson on the phone. She founded the website, hotghettomess.com,
right,
when she was a law school student. She's also a producer on the show. Hey, Jam, can you explain to me why you started this site?
Hi, everybody. Hi, Charlie. I started the site because, you know, I don't know about you, but a lot of us get these emails, you know, with all these pictures. Usually the subject line says something like, look at your mama, get your cousins. And, you know, we have all these pictures. Of this.
I get a lot of those.
Exactly.
All the time.
And the multicolored weeds, while the grills and the cars and all that. And so, you know, I thought, is there a way to use these images, which are just floating around the internet without any context? Is there a way to put them in a context that creates some sort of social commentary, some sort of discussion about what's in these images and if these images are actually indicative of some larger problems in the community that are really not funny? So I'm using these images to say, you know, we can all sit and laugh about this, but it's really not funny, and we need to have a serious discussion about how we're living.
So I'm going to ask you a question. I know you've been asked, and you're aware that this is a little bit controversial. Mm-hmm. How is it seeing negative images about black folks and folks who live in urban environments? How can that be a positive thing?
My philosophy is that these negative images are out there. So what I've done is put them into context, and I don't see what can be more powerful than an African-American putting out images and saying, this is not who we are. I mean, it seems like people are fine with just spreading this stuff all over the world, but when I put it out there and say, hey, look at all these pictures, this really isn't who we are. We really have to do better than this. Then people get upset. So I just find it a little odd. And the show, contrary to a lot of people's beliefs, are not just a bunch of funny videos. We actually go into the community. We interview people. We ask them about their opinions, about their images in the media, about women in music videos, about cultural concepts like stop snitching, American history. There are black history facts in it. So it's not just this 30 minutes of ignorant videos where
some girl shaking her
at the beginning and then Charlie,
you know what,
at the end and we're done.
Now, Charlie, the concept has detractors and it scared off a couple of advertisers, Home Depot, State Farm Insurance, they've pulled out. Do you understand why?
Do I understand why? Yeah, because they were paranoid. I mean, you know, it's the light of the times we're living in right now. A lot of racial issues have come to the front in the media lately with, you know, things that have happened in the comedy world. A lot of DJs have gotten in trouble. You know, so right now everybody's kind of nervous. But it's only a misunderstanding. When they see what we've done, then I'm sure that they'll come back. It won't be like they'll be like, hey, I don't want to be involved with that. Because we're not doing nothing. At the end of the day, we're not doing nothing wrong. We're not doing nothing negative. We're not trying to hurt black people or hurt, you know, embarrass anybody. Because at the end of the day, if you really, really get down to it, you're saying to us, to Jam, to Reggie, to myself, that, because none of us are ignorant people, that we sat down and said, you know what, let's make a joke out of black people.
Right.
And that is not what we're doing. And and that's why it's kind of, you know, it's kind of frustrating when you hear these people write editorial or when one of the people pull out as far as one of your backers pulls out.
Well, Jam, you know that
we don't want to be involved. It's like you're looking at us going, you guys did this, and you don't even realize, like, you guys are putting out something that's going to hurt black people, and we don't want to be involved with you. And that's exactly what we're not doing.
Well, Jim, you know there's a petition going around to have the show taken off the air. There's been some personal attacks on various blogs about you.
Sure.
What if people don't get it? You may have this really great intention, but what if people just watch the show and they're just laughing at black people acting like they think that all black people act?
You know, I think the basic premise of your question really sort of gets to this problem that the black community, in particular the young black community, we underestimate them. They can think. This show is not nuanced. The show is actually more in your face and more hits you over the head with the message than the website is. After every segment of clips, there's commentary about what we just saw. There's a commentary at the end of the show about what we just saw and sort of like an inspirational message to challenge everybody to look at their lives. So it's not this sort of, you know, you have to wade through all of these things to find the message. I mean, the very title of the show is Hot Ghetto Mess, We Got to Do Better. Everyone leaves off the We Got to Do Better part and just concentrates on Hot Ghetto Mess. And all I ask is that four intelligent people would not get an opportunity like this and do a shucking and jiving coon fest. And it's insulting to think that we would do that. On the other hand, I just want people to give it a chance and see what you think. I think there's a danger here that any creator, any producer, any network that is starting to think outside the box in terms of racial issues, whenever you have a different perspective and a different approach, everyone gets so nervous. And I think it's time that we give things a chance. You know, Aaron Magruder gets a lot of flack. I mean, everyone is just in this monolithic kind of lockstep hysteria. And if you say anything that may go against somebody, you know, we go crazy without actually thinking, hey, this could be helpful. This could start some important conversations. This could stimulate dialogue. And I'm going to just say one little story, and I'll be quiet. This show was actually shown to a group of I got a siren in the background. This show was shown to a group of teenagers. And after those teenagers watched the show, those kids sat there and spoke for an hour and a half about what they just saw, what the images meant, why they think people act that way, what they think mainstream America thinks of it, and what we can do about it. And so any program that's going to spawn that sort of dialogue and that sort of discussion should be welcomed with open arms by the community and not just run away from in this, like, paranoid hysteria about something they've never even seen.
Well, we'll let people watch the show and they can decide for themselves. Charlie Murphy and Jam Donison.
I would also like to add, too, that these very things that we're being accused of, you know, that people are afraid of, if they really want to champion that cause, it's not like, you know, it's not real problems out there to go after.
Absolutely.
That have in existence for over the last 10 years. And that's why I'm amazed that now all of a sudden you want to jump up and get him and go after a show that never even aired one date yet. And there's stuff that has been on TV for the last 10 years and it's on there every day. Okay, and nothing is said. And it's real. You know, this is real. This is not somebody trying to help anybody. This is somebody straight up exploiting. And you'll say nothing about them, but you're so hyped up about this, and this has never aired before, and that's not what we're trying to do. We're not trying to hurt nobody.
Well, got to let people watch for themselves. Charlie Murphy, host of Hot Ghetto Mess, and Jam Donaldson, founder of HotGhettoMess.com. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. All right, let's check a quick news update with Matt Martinez.
Thanks, guys. After debating all through the night over the wisdom of an amendment for troop withdrawals from Iraq, members of the U.S. Senate ended their session this morning. The debate was capped by a procedural vote to break a GOP-led filibuster. A new intelligence estimate says that al-Qaeda terrorists in Iraq will likely mount an attack in the U.S. within the next 3 years. The report outlines how al-Qaeda has rebuilt its operational capabilities and senior leadership and restored safe havens along the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. Investigators say that pro wrestler Chris Benoit was on steroids when he killed his wife and young son and hanged himself. But they are not saying whether that played a role in the killings. Benoit's body also tested positive for the anti-anxiety drug Xanax and the painkiller hydrocodone. 189 people are confirmed dead in the crash of the Brazilian TAM airliner that crashed on Tuesday. The airplane cleared the airport fence at the end of the runway in Sao Paulo and slammed into a gas station and a TAM building. And Microsoft says that the head of its gaming business will leave the company to join game maker Electronic Arts. Peter Moore steps down 2 weeks after Microsoft said it would spend more than $1 billion to fix an unacceptable number of broken Xbox 360 game consoles. I'm Matt Martinez, NPR News.
Hey there. It's the Bryant Park Project. I thought we were going to play music there, Maddie. What happened? No?
No, Matt's shaking his head. No.
No music.
No.
This is NPR. We don't have money for a thing like bumper music. Well, I don't know if Rupert Murdoch has officially declared his interest in buying Hot Ghetto Mess. It seems like a natural fit. But I do know that he is very interested in buying the Dow Jones company, Dow Jones Media, and he's got a huge billion-dollar bid out there. And in fact, it's been approved by the board. He's getting ever closer to acquiring Dow Jones, which would really mean he would own the Wall Street Journal. And this is a sort of a big deal in the journalism community, obviously, because Rupert Murdoch is known for kind of exercising his control over things that he owns.
Do you think there'd be a big gossip column in the Wall Street Journal now?
Page 7.
Basic blind items about the head of Bezos from Amazon.
Except there would be like a pencil drawing of the person like they do on the cover of the Wall Street Journal. Now, standing in the way, possibly, of Rupert Murdoch officially acquiring the company is the Bancroft family. They own the majority of the stock in Dow Jones. And he has to sort of go and convince them that he is not going to try to put his Murdoch stank all over the paper. And in fact, it's interesting because of all the things that he owns, there is one little kind of shelter from the storm of Rupert Murdoch's kind of influence. And it is, believe it or not, The Simpsons.
Marge, the couch is lumpy.
That's because you're sitting on me, you lummox.
Kent Brockman.
I invited him to stay with us for a few days. His career is ruined, and I was afraid he might commit you-know-what aside.
I'm sorry, Marge, but I won't live under the same roof as a member of the liberal media.
You'll have to excuse him. He's been watching a lot of Fox News.
Did you know that every day Mexican gays sneak into this country and unplug our brain-dead ladies?
I did not know that. And they have actually, you know, portrayed Rupert Murdoch on the show. And this is something surprisingly – not surprisingly, but I guess interestingly – that the Bancroft family kind of wants from Rupert Murdoch. They want him to sort of agree that he's not going to try to influence the Wall Street Journal. So the question I guess is like, what can the Bancroft family learn from The Simpsons? The Simpsons seem to be able to get away with almost anything. And actually we've got somebody here who has been thinking about The Simpsons a lot, John Ortvid. He's editorial associate with Vanity Fair, and in this month's issue, he put together this amazing oral history of The Simpsons, which if you're like me and you love The Simpsons, this is like...
It's fantastic reading.
It's good.
And I'm not just saying
reading.
That because you're sitting there.
John, thanks for coming over.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, so how did The Simpsons manage to get this kind of... How did they escape Rudolph's, Rudolph? What's
Rudolph.
His name?
Rudolph.
The red-nosed brain owner?
The red-nosed billionaire.
Yeah. How did they escape his iron fist?
Well, when the Simpsons started on the Tracy Ullman show, it really got on the air because of Jim Brooks, who was the producer behind it. And Jim Brooks had a reputation in Hollywood that was pretty much tops. And he brought this idea to Barry Diller, and Barry Diller brought it to Rupert Murdoch. And from the beginning, Rupert Murdoch really had very, very little control over content and had very little interest in having control of the content of The Simpsons. And it comes down to trusting Jim Brooks. Whatever Jim Brooks does makes a lot of money. So they knew he would hire writers and producers who would, you know, their content would be the most profitable content.
Yeah, but Rupert Murdoch has gone up against powerful people before in other industries, and he's been able to kind of make, you know, the New York Post fashion it in his interest, and Fox News, of course. Was there something about The Simpsons, like, and is there something that the Bancroft family could learn early on? Is it just make a lot of money, or is it just be tough to Murdoch?
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, that there's a big difference between The Simpsons and The Wall Street Journal. I mean, The Simpsons is a cartoon satire, and The Wall Street Journal is an editorial-heavy newspaper. And, you know, I think it would be very, you know, the accusation against Murdoch is that he's used his papers and his outlets to defame his enemies and to curry favor with politicians and to promote his friends. And I think it would be it would have been, and it would be even more now, extremely difficult to use The Simpsons to do that.
So, sorry, geez Louise, do we have the craziest mic screens in here? Every time you look at it, it bangs into the microphone. Does it essentially come down to money, you think, for a guy like Rupert Murdoch? Like, The Simpsons is just a financial juggernaut. And is it like, if you make a lot of money, then Rupert Murdoch will let you do whatever you want? Or is he more of an ideologue, you think? Like, he cares about the message.
I mean, I can't speak to whether he's an ideologue or whether he's just into making money. But I know The Simpsons, you know, especially as opposed to when you consider The Wall Street Journal, I mean, I think the problem of Rupert Murdoch's interference and why he stayed away from The Simpsons, it has to do with sort of the principal agent problem, where Rupert Murdoch, as the chief shareholder of News Corp, he wants to make as much money as possible. So he puts into place managers, guys like Jim Brooks at The Simpsons, or hopefully at The Wall Street Journal, their editors, or he keeps them in place, who are going to make him the most money possible. And there's an argument to be made that if the editorial content of The Wall Street Journal changed, its audience, its readers would know that, would notice, and they would, you know, potentially abandon it.
Are you a fan of The Simpsons?
I'm a huge fan of The Simpsons.
So was this like your dream assignment as an editorial associate to get to interview like Rupert Murdoch and all the people who created The Simpsons?
Total dream. Rupert Murdoch, he's a great interview, and he sat with me and he chatted. And
is he opposing?
No.
No, not
no,
at all.
No, he was very – I think – I don't know this, but I suspect that Rupert Murdoch really likes talking about The Simpsons. And to be, you know, to give The Simpsons credit, they made his network what it was. That show's made, you know, certainly at the beginning, everything at Fox was struggling, and The Simpsons was the one thing that brought in a ton of money right from the beginning.
Yeah, they put it up against The Cosby Show. I had totally forgotten that till I was reading some of these articles. Well, listen, John, hey, thanks for coming down and talking to us about all things Simpson. Appreciate it. That's John Orfit. He's a contributing associate editor. That's his official title, which if I said it wrong was going to get him in trouble, at Vanity Fair. Also, check out our blog where we have a link to that piece and also a really nice piece by Jack Schaefer that he did for Slate Magazine, which kind of lays out some of the same stuff.
Support for NPR comes from AT&T. Introducing wireless from AT&T, formerly Singular. The new AT&T, your world delivered. Boston Scientific, committed to delivering what's next in medical technology to help clinicians improve and extend lives. BostonScientific.com. And the Kauffman Foundation, featuring Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism by Will Baumol, Bob Litton, and Carl Schramm at Kauffman.org. This is NPR.
You are listening to the Bryant Park Project from New York. I'm Luke Burbank. Coming up, we've got the lowdown and the latest on this very mysterious but very exciting movie trailer called Project Cloverfield.
I know. I feel like a sleuth every time
I whisper. The entire interview, you have to whisper.
And Google about it. I'm Allison Stewart. Big news today. It was actually from yesterday, but reverberating into today. The National Intelligence Estimate was released, and it was pretty clear Al-Qaeda is strong, willing, and seemingly able to make trouble for the United States. It also considers Iraq a franchise location, kind of. But let's back up. Just last week, Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman, an independent, he expressed his support for the way things are going in Iraq.
That counteroffensive is working to drop sectarian violence in Baghdad and to put Al-Qaeda on the run?
On the run towards being stronger, perhaps? Very mixed messages we're getting these days. We wanted to try to clear things up a little bit. Daniel Byman is a professor at Georgetown University, where he is the director of the Center for Peace and Security Studies, as well as a fellow at the Brookings Institution. So Daniel, the NIE says Al-Qaeda wants to, quote, leverage its position in Iraq and hopes to encourage regional groups to follow its lead. Does it have that kind of sway?
It has some influence in Iraq. It's internationally called for people to go to Iraq, and people have responded. Iraq was a potent enough emotional cause where people were going there anyway, but having Al-Qaeda's weight behind it certainly has made a difference.
One of the things about the estimate, if you read it, is you get the sense that Al-Qaeda is able to evolve and shape-shift. How can they do that so easily?
Al-Qaeda has a very, very flexible organizational structure. They're able to both do top-down operations and also bottom-up ones. This is in large part due to the quality of the leadership. They've taken a lot of hits, but they've shown themselves to be exceptionally resilient.
Now, the NIE was developed by 16 of our spy agencies, from the FBI to the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, and they found out that Al-Qaeda is supposedly seeking biological weapons, has a focus on targeting American political and economic infrastructure. And they also said they're interested in mass casualties. Why mass casualties as opposed to just something symbolic, let's say?
Well, Al-Qaeda has a view that mass casualties are a way of shocking the American people. Their ideal combination, though, would be something symbolic and inflicting significant life. Their view is that the American people will only pay attention to what Al-Qaeda believes are America's injustices if they're literally bled into doing so.
The report also points the finger at Pakistan's tribal areas as a safe haven where Al-Qaeda has been able to incubate some. I thought that we were best friends, BFFs, with Pervez Musharraf, and that he was going to help us any way he can. Is this a signal that he's not helping us or that he is in a position where he can't?
A little bit of both. Pakistan has at times tried to go after various sanctuaries in the tribal areas, and its forces have taken a pretty heavy beating. That said, its military and security forces are indirectly aiding a bunch of jihadist groups in fighting in Kashmir and also the remnants of the Taliban fighting in Afghanistan. So it's not just incapacity, it's also a fundamental unwillingness to go as hard as they can against the broader jihadist movement.
Another point in the report, which is I think what we saw in Glasgow and London recently, are these sort of self-generating groups, these independent groups who just sign on to the cause. Because, in your opinion, is that really a big threat?
That's actually an extremely important threat from a U.S. perspective. Buried in the key judgments were a bit of good news, which is that there isn't a problem of domestic radicalization in the United States comparable to what we see in the Muslim populations in Europe. But that said, I don't think anyone would be surprised if an angry individual in the United States, perhaps a young Muslim angry about U.S. policy towards Iraq or towards Israel, picked up a weapon and simply started shooting people. And that low-level, self-generating radicalization could be a real problem for America.
Daniel Byman is a professor at Georgetown University and a director for the Center for Peace and Security Studies. Thanks for explaining it all to us, Daniel. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You know, one weapon that not even Al-Qaeda would dare try to harness for the forces of evil is the mighty badger. This was the best story of the week, I think, Allison.
This one is almost too good/bad to believe.
Yeah, in Iraq, in a city called Basra, people swear that they are being terrorized by this like Iraqi chupacabra. They say it's a bear-like animal and it's maybe eaten cows and carried people off. One woman, this was a great quote, she said the animal was, quote, swift as a deer, had the body of a dog, but the head of a monkey.
Now, the other part of the story, which is amazing, is that the rumor going around was that the British military had introduced these badgers to Iraq as some sort of fighting tool.
Which then precipitated the British military having to release
a statement that said we in fact, the British military have not introduced monkey-headed, furious badgers into the city of Basra. They had to deny that.
But one thing a friend of mine who's a reporter in Iraq said that is interesting there is perception is reality. That if a rumor like this starts, that it just gains control and gains speed, which is why the British military had to come out and say something like that.
Right. So we kind of got us wondering, though. I mean, what if, heaven forbid, some kind of terrible forces did release a super race of terrible – would there be a race? Is that a race? Super species of furious badgers. And we actually found someone who knows all about badgers. That's David Shepherdson. He's a conservation scientist at the Oregon Zoo, and he did his PhD work in badgerology. Hi, David.
Hi, good morning.
Hey, thanks so much for coming on our show. From Oregon, where you're based, what would you say the odds are that honey badgers are stalking Iraqi citizens? Would you say the chances are excellent?
I would think it's pretty unlikely.
Oh, really?
Honey badgers don't eat people, and they tend to shy away from people if they can. But having said that, if you cornered a honey badger, I'd put the money on the honey badger.
with such a sweet name, don't steal his honey. Is it like a Pooh Bear of badgers, or are these guys pretty badass?
Well, they're pretty ferocious. I mean, they've been the 2003 Guinness Book of Records described them as pound for pound the most powerful creature in Africa.
Wow.
And they have been recorded of keeping lions off of their kills and things. But they actually don't eat big things. They mainly eat insects and rodents, possibly small antelope. So, you know, they don't eat big animals. They certainly don't eat people. But, you know, if you tried to corner one, it would be a whole different story.
Could you? I mean, you couldn't form, like, an evil badger army that would actually do your bidding, right? I mean, scientifically, that's unlikely.
No, you really couldn't do that. I should say also they're not really badgers. They're called badgers, but they're mustelids, but they're actually not directly related to the badger family. So they're not actually a badger.
Now, I can't help but notice in looking up this story that a lot of the coverage of it was picked up in the UK.
Mm.
And by the classiness in your voice, I detect you also hail from England. And I'm wondering why the badger obsession in the UK?
Well, the British are very fond of their badger. You know, the badger in Britain lives in social groups, and they live in these holes in the ground, which go from generation to generation. So you can read books about a badger set that was by a particular church 300 years ago, and you can still go and visit that badger family. They'll come, and people feed them on their back patios. The British badger is a little different from the other badgers, like the American badger, for example, in that it is social, and it's actually not quite as ferocious and aggressive as the American badger.
And what do you call a group of badgers?
A seat.
A seek. S-E-E-K?
C-E-T-E, I believe.
C-E-E-T. Okay, I got a new
Scrabble. It's not used very often.
Well, I have a new Scrabble word. Thank you.
Yeah. A seat of badgers. Try challenging that, Bill Wolf. A seat of badgers. That's like a murder of crows. I thought murder of crows was maybe – that's still probably a little bit weirder.
Or what about a crush of rhinos?
Oh, that's an actual – that's a –
That's a group of rhino, yeah.
Wow. So, I mean, what's the plan if you – let's say that you are someone in Basra and you did come up on a honey badger.
Mm.
And
with an attitude.
What would the best strategy? You just run the other way?
The best strategy would be to walk slowly in the other direction and not try and interfere with it. I have actually been in an enclosure with a honey badger myself, and I'm still alive, and I have both my limbs. This was a very playful honey badger. So they're not always ferocious under the right circumstances.
Well, David, it's really amazing that you've lived to tell the tale of your time in the octagon with the honey badger, and we're the better for it. Thanks for coming on the Bryant Park Project.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's David Shepherdson, a conservation scientist at the Oregon Zoo.
So if you find yourself in Basra facing a badger, now you know what to do. What if you're online and you want to know more about the J.J. Abrams film, The Secret One? We'll fill you in on that in just a moment, but first, some news.
Thanks, guys. A marathon Senate debate on Iraq ended this morning with a procedural vote to break a GOP-led filibuster. Democrats forced Republicans to make good on the filibuster threat against a troop withdrawal amendment by holding an all-night session. A new national intelligence estimate says that al-Qaeda terrorists in Iraq will likely mount an attack in the U.S. within the next 3 years. Meanwhile, military officials say that a senior operative for al-Qaeda in Iraq has said that a prominent al-Qaeda-led group called the Islamic State of Iraq is just a front and its leader fictitious. Investigators looking into the death of pro wrestler Chris Benoit say that he was on steroids when he killed his wife and young son and then hanged himself. Benoit's body also tested positive for Xanax and hydrocodone. 189 people are confirmed dead in the crash of Tuesday's TAM Airlines Flight 3054 in Sao Paulo. The airplane appears to have tried to take off again. It cleared the airport fence at the end of the runway, but then slammed into a gas station and a TAM building. And the U.S. publisher of the latest Harry Potter book is scrambling to kill dozens of purported versions that have been popping up on the internet. One of the versions contains digital images of what are claimed to be all 36 chapters. Scholastic says the versions all look convincing, but notes that they are all different. The company isn't saying which might have it right. I'm Matt Martinez. Those are the latest headlines. The latest news is always online at npr.org.
It's that time of the show when we wander through the stories worth an honorable mention. It's called The Ramble. Girl fight in the Democratic Party. Elizabeth Edwards says Mrs. Hillary Clinton.
I got really excited at the first part of that sentence, and then I got really unexcited in the second half.
Well, apparently Elizabeth Edwards, the wife of presidential candidate, that's what they call it, says that the other presidential candidate, the woman one, Mrs. Hillary Clinton, Senator Clinton, is not a big an advocate of women's issues as John Edwards is. The interview is in Salon.com.
Do you think that's because Mrs. Clinton stood by her man in that way after his public infidelity?
She didn't mention that. It was
Is
more
that
about. No, it was more about. It was implied that Senator Clinton saying you should vote for me because I'm a woman isn't enough for women to feel that they should vote for her. Like, what have you done for me lately, Mrs. Clinton, to the female Democratic voters?
Well, speaking of. I was going to say the marital bed, but I don't even know really if that is a good segue or not. It's probably not. But HBO is rolling out this new show this fall called Tell Me You Love Me. And it's about three married couples. And it is apparently supposed to be the most sexually explicit primetime television show ever. That includes regular TV and cable.
And think about that.
Yeah, like
we've seen The Sopranos.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, just the Sipowicz butt scenes in NYPD Blue scarred me for years. And I have to say, on the list of really steamy things I want to see, it's married people getting their marriedness on. Couldn't it be the raciest show ever about a strip club? That would be about married couples. All right, I'm sorry.
A new BlackBerry is available, and supposedly it was the first dual-mode BlackBerry. It's going to have wireless voice data, it's going to have Wi-Fi, GPS, a media player, an expandable memory slot for 32 gigabytes. So if you are married and your spouse has one, now he or she will really never talk to you.
Now, Allison, the last, like, now we're going on, I don't know, day 15 of Cloverfield
I believe.
Watch.
Yes.
Where basically what happens is I work really hard and you and Matt tell each other updates about some cryptic websites you've been to that you're so proud of.
We are just Googling Cloverfield, Slesho, 11808. And if you don't know what I'm babbling about, this is
you're
all...
called Luke Burbank.
This is all part of this online treasure hunt for information about this new super secret J.J. Abrams movie. J.J. Abrams, obviously behind Alias,
Lost.
He's now working on the new Star Trek. Now, this all started when Matt Martinez went to see the Transformers, came in and told us about this movie trailer he saw that looked like it was shot with a home video camera. The scene is that this guy's going away party in New York. His name's Rob. And then suddenly the party is interrupted with what people at the party think could be an earthquake, but it turns out to be much more.
What was that noise?
It sounded like an animal.
Phone calls are pouring into the New York One newsroom as a thunderous roaring sound.
Do you see something on the roof?
What animal sounds like that? It's shaking everywhere, man. It's like tremors.
Looks like you should have left town a little bit earlier.
Crap.
Come on, tell me if you saw that movie trailer and then just saw the release date, you wouldn't run to the internet and start Googling and trying to figure out what this movie
that
is.
That was seriously terrifying. I hadn't actually heard that clip, but with the headphones on, that fryer-breathing dragon or whatever it was.
Well, we don't know what it is. So people have started to dig a little bit, apparently, and there's no real information. There's one website officially that we know that's 1808.com. It's got some pictures that seems to be the aftermath of something, but there's all these clues in the trailer. One of the guys at the party's wearing a shirt that says Slusho. You find out there's a website, slusho.jp. That's got something to do with the movie. If you Google just a little bit farther, some people have discovered that this is going by the code name Cloverfield because, for example, at the New York Film Department, there is a permit filed for Cloverfield in downtown New York. If you go a little bit further, you dig a little deeper in, you find Cloverfield is the name of a hangar out in Santa Monica Airport where they make movies. So this is just this huge viral marketing campaign, and apparently there are other websites out there, other clues in the trailer, and people are just waiting for J.J. Abrams or Paramount Movies to say, hey, this is what this film is about.
Wow. I have to say, you think that you can't get just played like that as a viewer? Like, they can't get me, and they totally got me.
I can't even tell you how many websites have become devoted to trying to figure out this mystery of Cloverfield 1808, J.J. Abrams. And he's going to be appearing at Comic-Con next Thursday to talk about Star Trek, and it's believed he might finally let us know what this movie's about.
I would be spending more time on Cloverfield if I wasn't spending so much time Googling Lindsay Lohan and drunk Google image.
How many hits? 1.27 million.
Yeah, exactly. One for every person in America, I think. Lindsay Lohan. What's her nickname? Lilo? No, Lilo.
Lilo.
Because like Lindsay, L-I, that sound. Lilo is, she's out of rehab and she's kicking it on the town, but I've seen some of these photos with her. She's holding a can of Red Bull. She's in Vegas. She's partying it up, but it would appear sans alcohol.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about this, aside from her being underage and all that kind of stuff, is that she is voluntarily wearing an ankle bracelet which detects if you have imbibed alcohol.
Yeah, it's like a little – it's not stylish. Don't get me wrong. Actually, you know what? There's somebody better here to tell us about it, and that would be producer extraordinaire MJ, don't call me Meg, Davis.
Hi, guys.
Hi,
MJ,
Meg.
MJ, so you were on the phone with a whole bunch of different people who make these bracelets, these detection bracelets. How does it work? How does it tell on your ankle if you've had a cocktail?
Well, it's got what they call a tamper-proof strap that connects two black boxes. They're both about the size of a pack of cards or a pack of cigarettes. One detects the what they call vapor perspiration that comes out of your body. Like, you produce like a liter of it a day. How gross is that? And basically it takes a base reading and it checks you once an hour, and if it comes up plus alcohol, then all of a sudden it starts checking you again and again and again, and it distributes this data to some major watchdog in Colorado.
Do they make a cankle bracelet?
I think it's one size fits all. Oh. One size fits all. But if you cut the strap, all of a sudden, like, alarms go off everywhere. So it's tamper-proof.
Truly tamper-proof? Can't you get a false positive
somehow?
You
can get a lot of false positives, they're saying, because different types of alcohol are released in different ways. So if you're getting your hair permed, there's some alcohol that comes out. That's for you, Luke.
Kenny G. Testing positive on a daily basis.
If you're in a crowd of drunken people, likely to be some cross-pollination on your scram bracelet.
Good to know. Good to know. MJ, thanks for the update.
You're welcome.
By the way, thank you for listening to the Bryant Park Project. We're at the end. We're at the end of the show. It went so fast. Wynn Rosenfeld, MJ Davis, David Gura helped keep this show afloat. The show continues on our blog. It's npr.org/Bryant Park, and you can comment there and tell us how much you love our show. And also go to iTunes and tell that guy for being such a jerk face.
We're going to have another big show coming your way this Friday. Until then, I'm Allison Stewart, and that's Luke Burbank. Blog it up.
I'm about to.